It is Monday, September the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Hurricane Irma batters its way onto U.S. shores.
Along the coast, we have storm surge inundation. Roads are underwater.
Remembering the 2001 terror attacks on the U.S., Pope Francis's emotional visit to Colombia.
This was a profoundly moving visit. It was successful on many levels. I think the Pope went to Colombia with a very specific mission to confirm the peace process is underway.
Also ahead, the music of Toni Braxton. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Hurricane Irma made landfall in the U.S. state of Florida on Sunday with quite a legacy left behind in the Caribbean. Classified as a typical Cape Verde hurricane, Irma developed on August 30th near the Cape Verde Islands in the eastern Atlantic Ocean. As it crossed the Atlantic, Irma developed into a Category 5 storm, the most powerful hurricane to form in the Atlantic since satellite observations began. And by the time the storm reached the Caribbean islands, it had winds approaching nearly 300 kilometers per hour. Those winds virtually flattened Barbuda, leaving its residents with the prospects of having to leave the island permanently. These two people from Britain were vacationing on Barbuda's sister island, Antigua, and spoke with reporters upon arriving back in London.
The hurricane itself was like being in a nightmare, and it was just horrible because the outcome wasn't actually as bad as other islands, so I don't even want to imagine what the other people felt. I was saying to Tanai, the wall's shaking, and she said, Rochelle, stop being over the top. And I said, no, touch the wall, it's shaking. And the wall was shaking.
We didn't know
what was going to happen.
So it just makes you think, because the people that are out there, they're so limited. They don't have enough resources, they don't have enough help. And the hurricane has been 3 days now, 4 days, and now they're picking up the pieces and they're anticipating another one. I think a lot more should be done from us worldwide to help them out. And the people over there, they need it.
Somewhat on Irma's path is Hurricane Jose. It is now a Category 3 storm with maximum sustained winds of 200 kilometers per hour, currently located a few hundred kilometers to the north of Puerto Rico, moving toward the northwest. A complicated high-altitude environment over the Atlantic Ocean is causing Jose to wobble around with no apparent landfall in sight. And having battered the Caribbean, where Irma left at least 25 people dead and massive amounts of destruction, the storm is now moving up the west coast of Florida. VOA's Lori London speaks with Dennis Felkin of the U.S. National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. With Irma's broad expanse, the storm covers the entire state of Florida, including Miami. Felkin talks about conditions on the ground late Sunday.
We actually had a curfew, which will go into effect from 7 p.m. tonight all the way to 7 a.m. tomorrow. Absolutely nobody will be allowed on the street. If you are, you're going to jail. It's as simple as that. We have a number of power lines that are down, a number of trees that are blocking the road. And along the coast, we have storm surge inundation. Roads are underwater. And on top of everything else, we have very strong tropical storm force winds blowing. And those, while they will come down gradually through the night, they're going to be strong, they're going to be gusty. So it's just not a good night to be out on the street.
Let's move forward to what you are expecting. What is Irma expected to do beyond now, but more into the evening and into tomorrow?
Irma right now is about 25 miles from Fort Myers, and it's moving out of the north. That's Florida's southwest coast. And it is going to come very close to, if not over, the city of Tampa by the time we get to the midnight hour. Winds have dropped down a little bit to 110 miles per hour. That's a strong Category 2 hurricane. This is still a very dangerous hurricane, and we don't want anybody thinking, oh, well, it's no longer a major hurricane. This is a piece of cake. No, it's a matter of semantics. I challenge anyone to tell me the difference in damage between 110 and 115 miles per hour. So this will be going on toward the north. My biggest concern, along with the wind, is going to be the storm surge. We're still looking at 10 to 15 feet of inundation from the storm surge along the southwest Florida coastline from Sanibel and Captiva all the way down to Cape Sable, and that is occurring as we speak. And as the storm moves up into the Tampa Bay area, we're looking at 5 to 8 feet of storm surge. That means 5 to 8 feet of water above normally dry ground. So you're looking at downtown Tampa, which could have 5 to 8 feet of water flowing through the streets.
Wow. Do you expect that we may see even more damage than we are yet to see? Because, as you said, it's not over. You know, as far
We will see more damage. The damage is already occurring. We will, of course, see more damage along Florida's west coast. We've yet to see the damage from the Florida Keys. There's a lot of communication switches out, including the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Key West. It has lost communications as of the middle of the afternoon, and the National Weather Service in San Antonio, Texas, has taken over the forecast responsibility for Key West until they can spin back up.
That is Dennis Felkin of the U.S. National Hurricane Center speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Hurricane Irma first made landfall in Florida at the southern tip of what is known as the Keys, a long stream of islands extending from near Miami to the southwest. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with the editor of the Upper Keys Reporter newspaper, David Goodhue, about the Keys.
It goes from Key Largo down to Key West. It's 30-some islands, more than that, that are uninhabited, but about 30 islands with homes, businesses, strung together by the overseas highway, which is part of U.S. 1.
What would be the structural damage, the infrastructure damage to a bridge like that?
The bridge, there's been some rumors say that some or unconfirmed reports that bridges were damaged. We confirm that actually they were not. They are passable. I mean, granted, they're going to have to assess their soundness once before they let people down. But I don't believe there is extensive bridge damage. Right now, there's a lot of flooding. The flooding will subside. It's storm surge. It's not necessarily like it. Well, it's not the kind of rain flooding we're seeing. You saw in Houston, this is the ocean, the bay, and the Gulf of Mexico rising because of the strong storm, but that will go down.
And what about the millions of people for whom Florida officials demanded evacuation?
This is the first time in a long time I've seen so many people in the Keys heed the warning and leave. I mean, granted, there are a tremendous amount of people that stayed, but that's usually a lot more people stay despite the warnings, because even these mandatory evacuations don't really mean what they literally say. I mean, they pretty much mean if you call 911, first responders will not come out to get you during the storm.
Hassel Tobias is with the VOA LATAM service. He is in southeast Florida near Miami, along with other VOA reporters and staff. He speaks now with Lori London about what forecasters are saying regarding the aftermath of Irma.
The worst is over, according to them. Right now, it's pretty much safe, but they still telling people to stay in their houses, to stay in the refugees, because the police is going to go outside and it's going to check out the city. They're going to make sure it's a safe city, and we can come back to the people, the citizens can come back to their houses in a safely manner. That's what they're going to be doing during this entire night. We still are in the curfew, means we cannot go out. But tomorrow morning, probably authorities will lift it up.
And when it was at its height, the hurricane, when it was really bad, can you describe what you were experiencing and seeing?
Of course, it was a lot of wind. The pressure on the windows from the hotel, you can feel it. You can feel like the wind hitting hard on the windows. We asked before if the windows were weather resistant, and fortunately they were and they are, and nothing happened. But we saw how the wind was pushing the trees completely down to the floor, was just ripping some traffic lights and pushing them away. I actually saw how the wind was pushing one of the cars parking behind the hotel, and how this car was little by little moving all the way to against a wall. So the wind was very, very strong, and it was a period of around 4 hours that the wind stayed that way. And little by little, the wind was calming down.
Tens of thousands of people in Florida left their homes. They headed to shelters so they would be safe as Hurricane Irma made its way through the state. A number of those shelters are being operated by the American Red Cross. The group spokesperson, Nigel Holderby, is in Orlando, Florida.
We have more than 500 shelters and evacuation centers that have been set up in the state of Florida, and that is through partnerships with our government agencies. So really the last estimate that we had was more than 132,000 people had sought shelter in some of the shelters that we're supporting and providing that evacuation center area.
We're utilizing a hotel, so a lot of the families that have come from their homes have come here and sought shelter here. It's a very safe building, lots of children, lots of families. At this point, they have asked everyone to come down from the higher floors in the hotel, and so we're down here in a sheltering area that's a safe area that's outside of the area that would be affected, away from windows and that sort of thing.
Irma is expected to continue to move, up the west coast of Florida. It will then move into the state of Georgia, and they say even the midwestern part of the U.S. over the next few days. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis has left Colombia after an emotional farewell. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos was on hand in Cartagena to accompany the Pope on the red carpet to the airliner carrying him back to Rome. Wrapping up his five-day visit, Pope Francis made a final appeal to the Colombians to reconcile under the peace deal signed last year between the government and the biggest rebel group aimed at ending Latin America's longest-running conflict. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with the CEO of Salt and Light Television Network in Toronto, Canada, Father Thomas Rosica, who also advises the Vatican when the Pope makes such journeys. Father Rosica talks about the success of the Pope's trip.
This was a profoundly moving visit. It was successful on many levels. I think the Pope went to Colombia with a very specific mission to confirm the peace process that's underway, to recognize its fragility, and to let the Colombian people know that every one of them has a hand in making this successful, making this work. So it was a visit of reconciliation. It was brought together in a remarkable way at the service of reconciliation on Friday. I was deeply moved in watching that, and I felt like I was there. The Pope's emotion, the testimonies of the people who had been the victims of the war that had gone on for so long, and none of them harbor grudges or anger. They're all at the service of peace, at the service of reconciliation. I think that's what the Pope's visit was.
He was in Colombia, part of a pledge that he said he would visit if a peace agreement was reached. But this conflict goes back more than 50 years. The divisions must be deep.
The divisions are extremely deep, even more than 50 years, although the current battle that's gone on for 50 years. But it's been such a beautiful, rich land, you know, the scenery, the countryside, the people, and yet so much division, so much hatred. So the Pope, I think we saw the relationship that the Pope has with President Santos. It's a close friendship, and they're in this together. The Pope played a very important part, I think, in leading up to what was the signing of the accords, and now it's going to be the acceptance of those accords. It's not a fait accompli. It's still fragile, and the Pope referred to that several times in his talks. The talks were masterfully written, masterfully woven together, and it was clear that the Pope knows the ground. He knows what's happening on the ground.
There was a second temporary truce with this other group, the ELN, that was founded in part by radical priests back in the 1960s. Did the Pope deal with that?
I think the Pope addressed the bigger question that, you know, we can't rely on temporary things. We have to, first of all, trust God in the process and trust the goodwill of people. And he spoke very strongly to both groups on the left and on the right that all of you have to be involved in all of this. There's no more time for recrimination, for blaming. Too much evil and loss of life has taken place, and we must move forward. So he wasn't championing any particular effort except the effort that God wants peace and that everybody has a hand in this.
He said he was praying for the well-being of all countries on the continent, but particularly Venezuela.
That's correct. How could he be so close to Venezuela and not mention the tragic situation that's taking place? And the church is paying very close attention to that that's going on. It's practically a civil war. And the Pope issued a very strong appeal for peace and asked the world to pray for peace in Venezuela. We've seen the images. We've read the stories of war, of devastation, of hunger, of poverty, of loss. And that is a very big country. It's a very important country, too. So I know that Pope Francis pays close attention to those countries.
The Pope also used the occasion of his visit to Cartagena to, again, denounce modern slavery, human trafficking, and defend the rights of immigrants.
That's right. The three times, I think, in the homily, we just finished televising the homily, three times. And it's rare that you see people burst into applause for Pope Francis's homilies. But the three, when he started crying out against that, the forms of slavery, the modern forms of slavery, both in the Angelus Address and then especially at the Mass, the Pope is very, very aware of that. And those are messages not just for Colombia. I think it's important to remember that when the Pope visits a particular country, he's not only bringing a message to that country, but he's using that country as a stage to address the world. And so many of the words that he addressed in Colombia can also be applied to many different countries.
That is Father Thomas Rusica. He's the CEO of Canada's Salt and Light Television Network, also an advisor to the Vatican, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. People came together over the weekend to honor America's veterans by renovating an outpatient clinic and housing facility for servicemen and women who have fallen on hard times. At an apartment building here in Washington, volunteers thank veterans for their service ahead of today's 16th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks on the U.S. Arash Arabasadi reports now from that Veterans Center in Southeast Washington.
This Veterans Center is both a clinic and home to veterans who've run into hardship. People like Vietnam vet Leroy Smith.
This place didn't exist. I really don't know. I have to do the best I can to try to make it. People have hard times, you know, and so this has really helped me out.
Smith says he wasn't homeless, but Terry, a self-described veteran of homelessness, says taxpayer-funded programs like this one saved his life.
I was able to get my life back, able to get my family back, able to walk down the street with my head up high. I was homeless for 10 years.
Really?
So I'm excited in helping these guys get back on their feet and help to beautify the neighborhood.
That help comes in forms of workforce training and permanent housing.
It's folks like these veterans that have honorably served and fought, sacrificed their lives and in some cases their health. It's incumbent on us to do what we can to ensure that they have the resources to be successful.
Many veterans who fought for the United States return home to a culture that sometimes stigmatizes those who ask for help.
The thing about it, it does help. It helps you physically, mentally, and everything else. And it brings you up, you know. So that's something that I think any vet that's out there that needs help, come to one of these places, and it'll help you out.
Organizers say that helps us all.
It's a moment for us as a community to pause and really find our, you know, a sense of ourselves so that we can help one another, and it really builds a stronger community.
The anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on American civilians is a time to reflect not only on the sacrifices made by members of the U.S. military, but also the resiliency of America in times of tragedy. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many psychologists say there are six basic emotions that are shared by all humans. They are anger, fear, surprise, disgust, happiness, and sadness. Now, a new study by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, has expanded that listing. The researchers played over 2,000 emotionally suggestive video clips to more than 800 men and women. They analyzed the group's responses to the videos and were able to identify 27 distinctive human emotions. Among the newly identified emotions are awe, peacefulness, horror, and adoration. The study's senior author, Dr. Keltner, a psychology professor at UC Berkeley, says that the 27 aren't necessarily isolated from each other, but are interconnected to others like smooth gradients of emotion. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. And now our report from the music department, the sounds of a R&B sensation.
And I can't stop thinking about the way things used to be. And I can't stop thinking about the love that you made for me. And I can't get you out of my head. How in the world would I begin to let you walk right out my life and blow my heart away?
And Toni Braxton, born in 1967 in the U.S. state of Maryland, is a renowned singer, songwriter, actress, and philanthropist. She rose to fame in the early 1990s, quickly becoming an R&B icon, a top-selling artist recognized as one of the most outstanding voices of her generation. Braxton's self-titled debut album was released in 1993. It sold over 10 million copies worldwide, spawning such hits as Breathe Again and earning her 3 Grammy Awards, including Best New Artist. Before all of this, Braxton and her 4 sisters, Tracy, Tawanda, Trina, and Tamar, began performing as the Braxtons in the late 1980s and were signed to Arista Records in 89. Even with all that success, Toni still liked being out on her own. On her own, Unbreak My Heart, which became her signature song and the second top-selling single of all time by a female artist, won 2 Grammys. In 2013, Braxton confirmed rumors that she was retiring to devote all of her time to acting. She said she had fallen out of love with making music. But by 2016, she was recording a new album and putting together a tour. And before all of this, the song, How Could an Angel Break My Heart, co-written by Braxton and Babyface, featuring Kenny G on the saxophone, went to the top of the charts. Braxton, huh? Whoa. Let me gather myself for a moment and tell you a little sports news before we say goodbye. Rafael Nadal has earned his third U.S. Open Tennis Championship, 16th Grand Slam title of his career, took it with a win over Kevin Anderson of South Africa, and then the day before, Sloane Stephens took the women's title. Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now some more from Tony Braxton.
Soft as a rose that blooms in May, he keeps her picture in a frame. And when he sleeps, he calls her name. I wonder if she makes him smile the way he used to smile at me. I hope she doesn't make him laugh, because his laugh belongs to me. How could an angel break my heart?
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hunger is a result of poverty, but it also causes poverty. People who do not have sufficient food and nutrition are less able to escape from poverty. In many countries, women, although they do much of the farming, lack access to training, credit, or land. Conflict, poor or corrupt management of natural resources, displacement of small farmers by natural disasters, and financial and economic crises that eliminate jobs at the lowest levels all contribute to creating conditions that push the poorest into hunger. To break this vicious cycle, the United States launched in 2010 the Feed the Future Initiative, which aims to reduce global hunger, poverty, and undernutrition by focusing on smallholder farmers, increasing investments in agriculture, and supporting country-owned plans for improving food security and nutrition, while generating opportunities for economic growth and trade. Back then, the U.S. government selected 19 countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to participate in the initiative based on 5 criteria. Since 2010, Feed the Future has helped 9 million people living in the participating countries pull themselves out of poverty. The passage of the U.S. Global Food Security Act of 2016 endorsed Feed the Future's approach and ushered in a new era of U.S. government global food security investment, a new corresponding global food security strategy developed by the U.S. government is guiding Feed the Future's work as the initiative enters its second phase. On August 31st, USAID Administrator Mark Green announced that Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Ghana, Guatemala, Honduras, Kenya, Mali, Nepal, Niger, Nigeria, Senegal, and Uganda were selected to participate in this new phase of Feed the Future. With the selection of these 12 countries, the second phase of Feed the Future will be focusing its efforts on promoting long-term, sustainable development that brings partners together to help people harness the power of smart agriculture to jumpstart their local economies and lift themselves out of poverty, said Administrator Green. By equipping people with the tools to feed themselves over the long term, Feed the Future is addressing the root causes of hunger and poverty. This long-term investment builds communities that are more resilient to drought, famine, and other natural disasters, and less dependent on emergency food assistance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.